This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're about to hear a performance of David Mamet's shortest play. Okay, I don't know for sure it's his shortest, but cut me a break. It's only 2 minutes and 6 seconds long. It's one of several very short plays that will be performed June 7th at the annual benefit for the Atlantic Theatre Company in New York. The company was co-founded by a small group of artists, including David Mamet and my guest, William H. Macy. The company practices an acting technique developed by Macy and Mamet. Macy has both performed in and directed works by David Mamet. He starred in the off-Broadway hit Oleana and co-starred with Joe Mantegna in the film Homicide. He also is featured in the films Things Change, Shadows and Fog, and Benny and June. Macy is the resident director of the Atlantic Theatre Company. Joining him to perform this very short play by David Mamet is Neil Pepe, artistic director of the company. Here's Macy to introduce it.
Mamet wrote this about how many years ago?
Must have been at least 10 more, probably.
Yeah, Dave lives up in Vermont, and he wrote a collection of Vermont pieces called Vermont Sketches, as a matter of fact. And they're published in one of his books. This one's called Deer Dogs, and it is, in many states, but I know in Vermont, if a dog runs deer, that is, if a dog chases deer, you can shoot the dog, because they have a tendency to run in packs, the dogs, and they'll run a deer to death. And so the law is, you can shoot dogs that run deer, because I guess the dog is supposed to be tied down. So this is Deer Dogs by Buffalo Dave Mamet.
Dogs running deer should be shot.
But who's to tell it's running deer? Law says you see a dog in pursuit of a deer, you can shoot him. Who's to say? Wait, you take Dave here, keeps his dog tied up. One day the dog, say Larry Thompson's dog, is running by. Dave's dog gets loose. Larry's dog's running deer. Someone sees it down the road later on. Larry's dog and Dave's dog. What does he do? Shoot them both.
How did Dave's dog get loose?
I'm saying a dog which is usually tied down, Dave's dog.
How did it get loose?
I'm saying one day when it is loose. I don't know how it got loose.
And was it running deer?
No.
How do you know?
Because it hasn't got a taste for him. It's a tame dog.
Well, how do you know?
Well, now, because it is a tame dog. You know that dog. I know what you're saying, that though the dog is tame, it gets loose, it starts running deer. Is that it?
Yeah.
But what I'm saying, this case, we know that the dog is tame. It's tame. It isn't running deer, all right? It's Dave's dog. It's tame. It's been tied up constantly.
How does it get loose?
Well, say Dave forgot to tie it up.
And where does it go?
I know what you're saying. It goes to the woods. All right.
What is it doing out there?
It's out with Larry Thompson's dog.
What are they doing?
Larry's dog's running deer.
And what is Dave's dog doing?
I don't know.
Well, I don't know either, but I'm going to assume it's running deer.
Would you shoot it?
Yes, I would.
You'd shoot Dave's dog?
Yes, I would.
You'd shoot Dave's dog?
Yes, I would.
Because you know that that's the dog that'll be caught. Not Larry Thompson's dog. That's the dog that will be caught. Shoot. It's a bad law. I'm sorry, I don't like it.
Well, you'll like it when you go out in the woods and there ain't no deer.
No, sir. Now, I'm going to tell you one more thing. What the law encourages a fellow to do is, I'm not saying you or me, but what it sets a man up to do is to say, I'm going to shoot that fella's dog. That's not right.
That's great.
That's Deer Dogs.
That's great. That's William Macy and Neil Pepe. Neil Pepe is the artistic director of the Atlantic Theatre Company, and William Macy is the director of the company. I think listening to David Mamet dialogue has made me more aware of the indirect ways that we talk to each other, you know, the way we kind of talk around things almost.
Yes.
I'm wondering, there's so many, interruptions and overlaps in the dialogue in not only this play, but in a lot of Mamet writing. How do you rehearse that? How do you rehearse the rhythms with each other?
Well, the main trick is you have to finish the sentences. You have to know what the lines, the words that you don't say, you have to know what they are, or basically what they are. As far as the rhythms go, they're inherent in the writing. They reveal themselves to you when you rehearse the thing. Dave also has this acting technique, which the Atlantic Theatre Company is all about, which is called practical aesthetics. And one of the tenets of that technique is that you can't act the words. You can only act the action. You can only figure out what the character, quote-unquote, the character wants in terms of the objective, i.e. what he wants from the other person. And you, through an analytical process, you figure out what that means to you. And that's what you act. Mm-hmm. And the words, essentially, are gibberish. You let them go. Let them come out as they will.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I'm thinking when somebody's talking over you, it's like a little collision in dialogue. And your impulse is to stop. I mean, well, some people go on, somebody else. You don't know whether you should stop or continue, but it's this... It's very jarring when it happens. Does that happen to you when you're rehearsing dialogue in which there are those overlaps and interruptions?
Yeah. Yeah. The first couple of times you do it, it's swell for the actor because someone interrupts you and you're... It's offensive. It's, well, let me finish. The trick is the 600th time you've done that speech to still be offended when you get interrupted.
Right. To still have it feel abrupt and like a collision.
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah.
That's a great way of putting it, though, a bunch of collisions. It's like several people running down a hallway trying to get to the door at the same time.
Neil, thanks a lot for joining us for the performance part.
Absolutely.
Of the program. Thanks, and good luck with the night of the benefit.
All right, I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, bye-bye. Bill Macy, how did you start working with David Mamet?
I went to a school in Vermont called Goddard College, and David had just graduated, and he came back as, I believe they called him, a teaching fellow, and so he was my teacher. And he taught an acting technique that was roughly Stanislavskian, and more specifically, it was the way Sandy Meisner taught. And he was my teacher, and he was the most outrageous man I'd ever met in my life, and he started writing plays. He came in one day with this collection of short sketches called Sexual Perversity in Chicago. And just about all of us looked at this writing and thought, this is pretty peculiar. This is brand new. And from there, we started a company together called the St. Nicholas Theater. We started it in college. And through a bunch of moves, it ended up in Chicago. And there at the St. Nicholas in Chicago, we did a lot of Dave's first plays and a lot of other people's plays, too. And it was quite successful. And we just hung out together. I presently owe him money, so it ensures my future employment.
If he pays you, you get to pay him back?
Yeah, I think he's going to make sure I keep getting jobs until I pay him off.
So had you been directed by anybody before working with Mamet?
Oh, yeah, I did plays in high school and in college. But what David brought to it, the first thing that he brought to the whole... subject of being an actor, which is really what my early college days were about. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I just knew that the only thing I'd ever been successful at or enjoyed was acting. What David brought to it was a sense of pride. He charged us as students to look at the whole thing in a broader sense, what our role in society was and what our responsibilities were. And he did it from a very Russian point of view, a very selfless, either get it together or get out, the world doesn't need you kind of an attitude. And he impressed on us, as Stanislavski said, that the task of the actor was to bring to the stage the life of the human soul, which is a lofty phrase, but he brought it right down to the nitty-gritty. And as a result, he had a work ethic in that class, which has never left me and held me in good stead, and which I've been trying to spread in the community also. Such things as be on time. It sounds like a silly thing, but in David's classes, if you were not on time, which was about 3 minutes before the class was to begin, the door was locked. Don't come in.
Really?
Do not come in.
Were you ever late?
Once or twice.
And you missed it?
Absolutely. And a couple of times it would be after you'd spent all week working on a scene that you were dying to do.
And how is that good discipline?
Well... Yeah, but about the second time you were late, you decided, perhaps I should not be late anymore. It would be so much easier to be on time than to go through all of this angst.
If you're just joining us, my guest is actor and director William H. Macy. He's a co-founder and the director of the Atlantic Theater Company, which has its big annual benefit coming up on June 7th. We're going to take a short break, then we'll be back. This is Fresh Air. Back with William H. Macy, resident director of the Atlantic Theater Company. Now, your students have written a book called A Practical Handbook for the Actor, which is based on the style of acting that you and David Mamet teach. In the introduction to the book, Mamet says that most acting is based on shame and guilt. Was that your experience when you were studying acting?
That was my experience when I studied anything in school. It's true. It's particularly bad in the acting profession for a couple of reasons. One, there is such a thing as the muse, and every once in a while, she will visit the actor, and you do the best work you've ever done. And you go back after the performance and say, what was it that allowed me to be that good? And it is indefinable. And so that's a very seductive thing. And what a lot of acting teachers try to do is capture the muse. They try to contain it somehow. And it can't be done. It cannot be done. Sometimes God just visits you and you are wonderful that night. To put your attention on that is folly because it's not controllable. What you can put your attention on is technique. And technique is something that is within your control. And so as Stanislavski said, play well or play badly, but play truthfully. And I think a lot of acting teachers, because they have no technique, because they've never sat down and said, what exactly is the technique, not the art, but the technique of acting, because they've never answered that question for themselves. What they try to teach is feelings, and feelings are so elusive, and emotions, that they end up talking gibberish to the students. And as David says in that introduction, there is a conspiracy. The students will not call the teachers on talking gibberish, and as a result, the teachers will praise the students sometime and damn them others. And generally speaking, with a lot of acting classes, it makes no sense on an intellectual level. It offends your intellect, your intelligence.
Did you study how to use emotional memory for performances, and do you consider that a legit or a gibberish approach?
I did study it briefly, and it's just so much nonsense. It doesn't work.
Explain how it's supposed to work and why it didn't work for you.
Well, the Stanislavski technique broke down into two sections. One was emotional preparation, and the other was the sense of objective, the through line, the action of the piece. Stanislavski invented basically both of those phrases. In the early part of his life, he worked a lot on emotional preparation, which Lee Strasberg was the champion of. And the way it works is, if I'm going to do this piece called Dear Dogs, and I'm playing the character Bunchy, and I'm trying to convince the other character, Larry, that it's wrong to shoot a dog, I would come up with an emotional... I would figure out what the emotional state that Bunchy is in. I would come up with an analogous emotional state that I have been through and put myself into that emotional state, and the speech would then take care of itself. Well, that's foolishness on many levels. One, it's almost impossible to control your emotions, in my opinion. You cannot control your emotions. And to whatever extent you can, it's really outside of any usefulness toward acting. Two, acting, in my opinion, doesn't have anything to do with emotions. And as a matter of fact, they are beside the point. Acting has to do with actions, which brings us to the second half of Stanislavski. And Sandy Meisner at the Neighborhood Playhouse was the great proponent of that. And that is figuring out what the character wants and acting that. In other words, my only job is to get the actor that I'm acting with, in this case it was Neil Pepe, was to get him to change his mind. And it's my job to do that, me personally. William H. Macy, I've got to change Neil Pepe, not some character doing it, because the character doesn't really exist. So I've sort of spun off into the stratosphere on you, but the idea is you can't control your emotions, so leave them outside. They will come or they will not come on their own, and there's nothing you can do about it.
So you don't teach emotional preparation for a theater piece?
No. On the contrary, we say we don't care how you feel about it, and if you really want to know the truth, how you feel about it is relatively boring. I don't know who said it, but boring emotions are fun to indulge in, but tiresome to watch.
What's the most emotion-packed scene that you've had to do in your career?
I don't know. I've died a couple of times, and this play, Oleana, at the end, I mean, this woman has wrecked his life. But, you know, Terry, I thought it was interesting, for me at least, what happened to me over the course of Oleana, which ran for 9 months, was that I consistently found myself going back to that final scene, which is so emotional and so charged, and saying to myself, settle down, cut out all that stuff. Once a week, I would have to go back and say to myself, simplify, simplify, because I would just fall in love with these little emotional turns and explosions that I'd come up with, and I would try to repeat them. And they're just not, they're beside the point.
So what would you be throwing overboard specifically?
Well, you know, one night I would let out some earth-shattering sighs. As a matter of fact, I did that one night, and it was quite a swell moment. I was quite proud of it. But, you know, being the cheap fellow that I am, I tried to do it the following night. And it didn't sound like a sigh. It sounded like I had emphysema. And I think it was just awful. So, you know, like the third night, I finally got it together to say, hey, practice what you preach. Just let that stuff go. There's another rule here, too, which I think many actors fall afoul of, and acting teachers by extension, which is, if you cry, the audience won't. If you get upset, the audience won't. What they're doing is having, they're vicariously, they're up on stage with you going through the thing at the same time. That's why we like to watch things. That's why our heart picks up when we're watching TV, and the bad guy's right around the corner, and the good guy's walking right into a trap. Your heart's pounding, because you're there, you're part of the thing. Well, if the actors pump up the emotion and essentially tell the audience everything that they're supposed to be feeling, it robs them of the experience. Much better, play it close to the chest and don't let all of that stuff out, except the stuff that will come out whether you want it to or not.
Right.
And the audience will get more bang for their buck.
I get the feeling with someone like you that you'd be a good actor no matter what technique you were using. Do you know what I mean? That even technique only goes so far, and that you're someone who's going to be a good actor one way or another. And that if a bad actor were using this technique, maybe they'd be a bad actor one way or another. What do you think?
Yes, I think technique cannot make you an actor, but it can make a good actor a better actor, and
yeah.
It can make a bad actor a competent actor.
Uh-huh.
It seems to me that everybody can act a role or two. If you're going to be a professional actor, you've got to be able to act more than roles than that, or you're not going to be able to make a living. But the idea of being simple and truthful on stage, anybody can learn to do it. And so, theoretically, everybody could play a role or two.
Now, you have your own theater that you co-founded in 1983, the Atlantic Theater Company.
I'm the godfather. It's not really my theater.
Right. Okay. I didn't mean it to sound quite that possessive.
Right.
But what are the advantages to you of having a home base like that and not being completely dependent on other people's theater companies and other people's movies?
A sense of community and a sense of home, and you know, I've been doing more films. That's what I'm trying to do. I've been on the road now for 2 years, so it's really swell to go over to the Atlantic Theater Company on 20th Street, and I walk in and I know everybody, and my picture's on the wall, and I can borrow a buck to get a Coke and, you know, take a nap on the couch if it's not already full, which it usually is. They teach classes at Atlantic, so generally speaking, the place is packed with students doing what this game called the repetition exercise, which makes you think like you've walked into Bellevue when you... It's odd.
Well, now I have to find out what the repetition exercise is.
Well, you're supposed to... The big thing is to be in the moment when you're on stage. So it's this game that Sandy Meisner made up that is about being in the moment, and you simply repeat until something happens to make you change. I won't bore you with the details, but it looks like this. It sounds like this. You've got on a green shirt. I've got on a green shirt. You've got on a green shirt. I've got on a green shirt. You've got on a green shirt. I've got on a green shirt. You're boring. I'm boring. You're boring. I'm boring. So you see these two people doing this all over in every corner of the theater. Outsiders think,
And you find that useful?
It's a fabulous game. The idea of taking your attention off of yourself when there are 1,300 people watching you is quite a trick. The only people who... You know who else has a rough time with that? Boxers. The idea of taking your attention off of yourself when there's a 6'3" man who's been training all his life to knock your head off, to take your attention off of that and put it on knocking his head off, that takes guts. And I think it's analogous, the kind of guts that an actor has to have, to stand in front of those people and get your attention off of yourself and put it somewhere else.
What's it like for you when you do an audition for a movie and you get your time with the casting director or with the director and you have a limited amount of time to make a good impression.
It's your worst nightmare. It's, you know those nightmares you have when you wake up and you say, whew, thank God I was only dreaming. Well, it's like that, except you weren't dreaming. It was real.
Right.
It's a hideous thing. It's hideous, particularly when it's a great role for you and you know you could just kick it to no end. And you've got to prove yourself to those people. And I happen to be rotten at it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not good at it at all.
What goes wrong for you at those auditions?
Oh, I have a tendency to get angry when I have to audition. And so, because I can't be angry, I end up being ironic and saying funny things that aren't that funny and are generally very insulting. They flew me out to L.A. one time for a series, and it had come down to me. I thought I had negotiated the money, which was more money than Canada takes in yearly. I thought my life was made. So they fly me out to L.A., didn't tell me anything. I walk into this room. There are three guys that are identical to me, sitting there looking like they're going to explode from nervousness. And it turns out, I didn't know the gig, but there are four of us for this role, and then there are four other roles that each have four people. All these people sitting in a room. I mean, you could have, if you could have figured out how to harness that energy, you could have run L.A. For a month on the energy of these people just sitting there sweating. And then one at a time, everybody goes into this giant room that had a 16-foot table with all these suits sitting at it, off in the dark, and in this lighted space, you get up and you do your thing. And they decide whether you're going to be rich for the next 5 years and perhaps a movie star for the rest of your life, or whether you're going to just get back on the airplane. Well, I freaked out. I walked into the room. I looked at these people. My hand to God. I looked at them and I said, would those of you who are important stand up? Well, that was that. They didn't crack a smile. So I went through and I did my audition, but yo, boy.
Oh, wow. Did you know you were going to say that?
No, I just knew that I was furious. It's so inhuman.
Well, Bill Macy, it's been great to talk with you. Thanks a lot.
You bet.
William H. Macy is the co-founder and artistic director of the Atlantic Theater Company. Their annual benefit, June 7th in New York, will feature very, very short plays performed by Macy, Giancarlo Esposito, Treat Williams, Griffin Dunn, and Eric Stoltz. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.